From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in hour number two of Forum, we'll talk about sprawl and hear from a detractor and a defender, as well as focusing our attention on sprawl as we see it through the world of art. Forum is next with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. And in this hour, we focus our attention on the pros and cons of sprawl as we try to pin down what the word actually means and how we ought to consider dealing with its effects. We also wanted to talk in this hour about art and sprawl. There's a major exhibit that's going on until the 3rd of March at the San Jose Museum of Art called Suburban Escape, The Art of California Sprawl. And we'll talk about that as well, conjoined in photography, painting, sculpture, and other media to sprawl. Let me tell you who's joining us for the hour. First of all, I want to welcome here in studio Ann Wolf, who's curator of that exhibit that I just referenced. She's also curator of exhibits and collections at the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno and has put together a book called Suburban Escape, The Art of California Sprawl, that goes with the exhibit. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you very much.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have in studio with us Gabriel Metcalf, who is executive director of SPUR, the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association. They're a public policy think tank, and they promote good planning and good government and been founded essentially to channel growth away from suburban sprawl and back into the urban core. Welcome, Gabriel Metcalf.
It's great to be here.
Good to have you, and also good to have with us by phone this morning Robert Brugman, who is professor of art history and architecture and urban planning at the University of Illinois at Chicago, author of a book called Sprawl, A Compact History. And welcome, Robert Brugman.
Great to be here.
Good to have you, and let me begin with you because you have a very different view of sprawl than most people who think of it as a pretty bad thing. In fact, you say in your book you want to inspire respect for the urban landscape, but that includes respect for what people call sprawl.
Yes, absolutely. I think what I found in my research was that sprawl, which many people think is a recent American thing driven by the automobile, is actually as old as cities. And the reason it's always been very successful and has now become the preferred mode of middle-class living everywhere is because it's offered so many benefits. So I don't say it's good or bad. I just say that it has offered a lot of benefits and certainly is no worse than any other kind of living, for example, high-density central city living.
Well, you hear all the bad things. It's economically inefficient, it's environmentally irresponsible, it's socially inequitable, and on, but you say there are benefits, and those benefits have to do with what, democratization and people getting greater privacy and greater choice in what they can do?
Yeah, I think it's what it's offered is mobility, privacy, and choice at a reasonable price that most people can afford, and I don't think that most of the complaints about sprawl are justified. For example, I don't think it's environmentally worse than central cities, and I don't think it's socially or aesthetically worse either. I think there's an enormous body of research that's supposed to prove these things, but if you look at any of it very carefully, it's really a house of cards.
This is a kind of cultural concept, sprawl. It's hard to define. It's a bit, in terms of defining it, it gets elusive, though it has a lot to do with time and place. How do you define it?
Well, I think the point of my book is that there's never been a good agreed-upon definition, and that's been very important for the anti-sprawl activists because if it were defined very carefully, then they would find that most of their proponents actually live in sprawl. If it's not current sprawl, it was sprawl of a previous generation. So I think there's been a very strong desire not to have it very carefully defined.
But as you say, from your perspective, it isn't new, it isn't unique in the United States, and maybe a catch-all to a lot of urban problems. A couple of cities that you cite early on are Kansas City and Tokyo that prove somewhat different views of sprawl. Talk about that.
Well, if you're looking at the thing that most Americans say when they first hear the word sprawl, they'll say that because people move further and further out from the city, there'll be longer and longer commutes, more and more congestion, and greater pollution. But if you look at this for even 10 minutes, you realize that Kansas City, very sprawling, 2,000 people per square mile, has very short commutes, on average 20 minutes. And then you look at the other side of the coin, if the anti-sprawl activists were right, then it would be a snap to get to from home to work in Tokyo. But Tokyo, which is very dense, very compact, and has arguably the best transportation system in the world, those commutes are horrendous. They're on average 46 minutes, and something like 60 or 70% of the people there have commutes of over an hour each way. So it's I think that when you even look for a few minutes at the arguments against sprawl, you see that they're either not very reliable or in some cases just dead wrong.
Robert Brugman, again, is professor of art history and architecture and urban planning at University of Illinois Chicago, author of Sprawl, A Compact History. Some of the ways of remedying sprawl, from your perspective, Professor Brugman, have led to greater sprawl, huh?
Well, at least they haven't solved the problem. I mean, for example, Portland, Oregon is America's most salient example of attempting to stop sprawl. And in a way, it did. It put a growth boundary around the built-up area, and that stopped the spread from going any further than that. On the other hand, Portland was never very sprawl. It was never very compact to begin with. It's very low density by American city standards, about half the density of Los Angeles area. And if you drive around the edge of Portland, it looks very much like anywhere else. And it's also had a very negative impact, these growth controls, on pushing house prices up. And that's, in fact, a major factor throughout the West Coast of the United States, where since about 1970, house prices, which used to be fairly similar to those in the United States, have just skyrocketed. And I think you can only imagine it has to be a lot of these growth measures that have played a major part in that.
Again, talking with Robert Brugman, his book is Sprawl, A Compact History. Gabriel Metcalf here with us in studios, executive director of SPUR, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association. They are, as I said earlier, public policy think tank that promotes good government and good planning, and I guess you could call yourself an anti-sprawl activist, couldn't you, Gabriel?
I guess you could.
So tell us, from Professor Brugman's perspective, maybe there's too much that's said in a bad way about sprawl, maybe not enough good things. From your perspective, it's pretty much all bad, isn't it?
Well, I think it's not all bad. I think it's clear that the mobility, the privacy, the choice, those characteristics the professor calls out are good. It's also clear that a lot of people like to live in what we're calling sprawl, and I would agree that it's a colloquial term, and if we're not precise about what we mean, it probably wraps in a little too much. But with all of that said, I don't think it's right to say that everything about sprawl is good. And if you really boil it down, I would say it's this. If you organize human settlement on the land in such a way that people have to drive to get anywhere, we will have oil wars and we will have global warming. And it basically depends on how important you think that is. I would never argue the fact that a lot of people like to live in sprawl. They do, obviously. But the costs of accommodating that preference may at some point come to seem too big to be worth it.
Well, you've said, we were just talking about the ongoing humanitarian crisis and refugee crisis in Iraq, and you've said that anyone who's opposed to the war in Iraq and living in a single-family suburban home is a hypocrite. That sounds pretty harsh.
Well, let me. What I really said is, if you're opposed to the Iraq war and you are promoting sprawl, you're a hypocrite. People's individual life choices are influenced by all sorts of complicated things, but your political stance should be that you're promoting compact development if you don't like oil wars.
You think, in other words, sprawl is definitely connected at the hip with greater oil costs and terrible dependency on the automobile, because we heard something different from Professor Brugman, and he goes into how, for example, a lot of public transportation buses where you only see five or six people are wasting more in the way of pollution or creating more pollution.
Yeah, well, look, there are a lot of factors. It's not only density that influences whether people drive. It's the location of jobs within the region. Are they close to where people live, or is there a spatial mismatch? It's the form of the street network, how wide the streets are, what their capacity is, how big the blocks are, and there are 100 other factors. But on average, vehicle miles traveled per capita goes up the lower density people live, and that is a fact.
Talking again with Gabriel Metcalf, who's executive director of SPUR, the San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association. One thing about sprawl, it means more expensive infrastructure. And that's certainly categorically true, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And
however, that infrastructure has been and probably still is affordable. In other words, when developers build a new subdivision on what was formerly farmland, they have to put in the infrastructure, and that's part of their costs of building out the development. And thus far, they have been able to afford it. So I don't think, you know, if you want to trust the market there, you can sort of say that that infrastructure is not the biggest problem. It's the externalized costs to the rest of the world that are the bigger problems.
What about, we're going to talk in a moment with Ann Wolf about sprawl and art. What about the aesthetics of sprawl? I mean, you keep hearing how ugly sprawl is.
Well,
some thoughts on that from you, Gabriel Metcalf?
You know, different people like different things. I find it hard to quibble with people's aesthetic preferences.
So what is the biggest problem for you with sprawl, then?
The biggest problem is that it's leading to a perhaps uninhabitable planet because of the global warming emissions caused by so many people being forced to drive.
Environmental problem. Well, we have a response to that, Robert Brugman?
Well, sure, I do. Unfortunately, it sounds like I agree with Gabriel on all of his factual statements. It's simply the diagnoses that I would disagree with. If you look at vehicle miles per traveled per person, these have escalated enormously since the 19th century, and it's part of what's made us so, in all of our affluent Western world, so much more pleasant to live in and allows so much more individual fulfillment. So I think that the idea that we should ratchet that back and suddenly have everyone travel less is the wrong answer. The right answer is to solve the problems of global warming and get new fuel. The automobile, like the bus and the train, they're all 19th century technologies. We should be onto something else by now, and I think that's the solution. Global warming, we can't solve that by just making people at a little bit higher density. If we brought the whole world up to a density of, let's say, a small Parisian apartment building, that wouldn't solve global warming. We'd have infinitely more energy use and more greenhouse emissions because most of the people, the poorest people in the world, aren't using much energy now. But we need lots more energy to pull them out of poverty if we are really going to make an impact on the biggest problems in the world, which aren't in the West. They're in the one-third of the world's urban population that lives in less than a dollar a day.
Gabriel Metcalf.
You know, much of the rest of the world is emulating the American settlement pattern, and most troubling would be China, which is outlawing bicycles from lots of cities and building highway and automobile infrastructure at a much greater pace than building public transit infrastructure, and then most importantly is building housing and jobs in locations that people must drive in order to get to it. So I think the professor is absolutely right that the United States by itself and even the Western industrialized world by itself cannot solve global warming. But the way we organize human settlement on the land, whether we put people in energy-intensive or energy-conserving configurations, is the single most important thing we can do as a species to solve global warming.
Talking about sprawl environmentally, politically, and also aesthetically, which brings us to Ann Wolf, who's curator of the current exhibit at the San Jose Museum of Art, Suburban Escape, the Art of California Sprawl. And before we talk about the aesthetics of sprawl, Ann Wolf, with you, politically, I guess Peter Saul was the only California artist who offered a kind of critical view of suburbia in the 60s. For a while, artists were sort of loath to do that, it would seem.
Well, it's very interesting to take a look at how artists have responded to issues of suburban development and tract home architecture and land use since the 1950s. This particular project brings together the works of artists who have been looking at these issues from 1950 to the present. And yes, you're right. In the 60s, Peter Saul was one of the only artists who was really being overtly critical of what was happening in relation to development, even though a larger cultural critique was ongoing at the time throughout California.
Yeah, you mentioned Malvina Reynolds, for example.
That's
you
right,
all
of course.
Live in little ticky-tacky houses in Daly City.
There's Malvina Reynolds' popular song, The Ticky-Tacky Houses. John Keats in 1957 wrote a book, The Crack in the Picture Window. But at the same time, much of the art being produced was kind of aerial imagery, or pop art was what was taking place at the time. And so there was this kind of detached response to the politics of sprawl. This really changes actually in the 80s when the art world opens up in content and becomes more acceptable in art. And so you see the work of artists dealing with environmentalism, issues related to the environment, as well as racial demographics in the suburbs. And that is really how things begin to open up in the 80s. And today you have artists producing more apocalyptic scenarios of the suburbs and suburban development.
Yeah, well, you go back early on in your book, in fact. I'm just opening it here. There's a picture. It starts with California's suburban frontier from Manifest Destiny to Maximum Density. Good title, good subtitle. There's a picture here by Mary Snowden, who I believe is a Bay Area artist. And she's got some soldier wrapped in an American flag with a woman by his side, obviously his wife, who's got an apron on and looks like a wonderful little housefrau. And they're landing on what looks like Levittown. I mean, they're going in, they're parachuting down, right?
Right. That painting by Mary Snowden is titled Levittown. Levittown, of course, is the quintessential American suburb of the East Coast. I'm often asked, why California? Why did you focus your particular book and exhibition on California? And the reason for that is really because California, of course, was the center of the military-industrial complex in the 40s. And following World War II, California kind of had this euphoric it was a euphoric place to return to. There was this suburban culture forming where numerous returning veterans were able to settle thanks to the GI Bill in many of the developments that sprung up throughout Northern California and the Bay Area, as well as in Lakewood. So Mary Snowden's painting really opens the exhibition. It opens the book, and many contemporary artists continued to respond and have used Levittown kind of as a reference point for much of their work.
But it seems like you've got the whole continuum in terms of artists. That is, those who are disagreeable, John Baldessari, for example, in his political art, where the suburbs are concerned, or the way they portray the suburbs, or exurban and maximum density areas, what we're calling sprawl, and those who almost celebrate it, really. I mean, the celebration, for example, I saw David Hockney exhibit down in Los Angeles at the Wilshire Metropolitan LA Museum, and David Hockney saw the suburbs as exotic, and it comes through in his work.
Absolutely. In putting together this survey of work, what you really see is that artists are responding not only to issues of sprawl, but looking at those issues through the lens of what's happening in the broader art movement. So in the early 1950s, as I was saying, you have aerial photographers dealing with kind of the topography of sprawl. In the 60s, you have pop artists like David Hockney and Ed Ruscha, who are just like Warhol was using popular imagery and kind of mass-produced subjects. They're looking at the surface and the facade, and actually Hockney is kind of celebrating that suburban culture that he's immersed himself in all of a sudden. In the 1970s, you have something very interesting happen in photography and the emergence of the new topographics photographers, and they begin to look at the altered landscape as well as the changing landscape through kind of this detached lens. Mostly black and white photography. And then, as I mentioned before, in the 80s, artists like Camilo Jose Vergara look at issues related to racial demographics and kind of the changing demographics as the suburbs, which are no longer considered kind of bastions of white culture and the white flight, but more becoming kind of these multicultural communities in the same way that artists become more engaged in issues related to environmentalism. Interestingly, in the 90s, you have this small, unaffiliated group of female artists who begin to kind of tackle some of the negative implications of growth, primarily because they are seeing the places that they call home change very, very quickly and very rapidly. And then some of the most contemporary artists in the show are creating kind of these apocalyptic scenarios, particularly Jeff Gillette, whose series of small mixed media painting sculptural pieces depict suburban homes that are under construction in flames, erupting in flames and exploding.
I notice there's a whole apocalyptic motif that runs through a lot of these suburban paintings, and conflagration is usually what we're seeing in those, or things on fire, as you just described them. But there's been a kind of hesitancy, many of these artists, to be all that political or to make a political statement overall. At least you seem to come to that conclusion.
You know, I do seem to come to that conclusion. And in talking with a lot of the artists and visiting a lot of the artists, what I've noticed is that many of them live in the suburbs. Many of them were raised in the suburbs, and that's where they consider their home. And I think In all, it is very difficult to be critical of your home place. People have memories of the suburban homes where they were raised. They have idealized notions of their childhood. And I certainly don't mean to generalize. There's certainly artists in the exhibition that are critical. But overall, there's kind of this almost an aloofness and unwillingness to kind of be overtly critical of the places they consider home.
I was thinking about an artist like Robert Bechtel, whose exhibit was recently here in San Francisco, and I got to see, and, you know, he does great automobiles, and you look at these automobiles, and they look so shiny and compelling in many ways, and you think, is he telling us that automobiles are perhaps a little bit too much of our culture because they're pervasive through so much of his work? Because clearly they are, and you look at Sproul and you identify him with automobiles, and then at the same time, he's being really very realistic in terms of a rendering of it almost looks like there's a kind of halo over the suburban world when he's painting it. You wonder, where does he stand? And maybe that's a good thing about his work. You don't know.
Well, it's I think much about the subject matter. I mean, suburbia tends to be characterized as characterless, and artists have responded in that way. Suburbia is about that homogenization and that flatness and that that detachment, and it's a place that you don't necessarily. I mean, it's homogenized, and so I think Bechtel is kind of course, an inheritor of kind of those ideas surrounding pop art, and is very much working with those same issues related to kind of surface quality of suburbia. Unlike some more contemporary artists like Larry Sultan or Todd Heido, who kind of try to break down that facade, that suburban facade, and kind of go inside the doors of suburbia, Bechtel, especially in the 60s, is working with that suburban facade.
Talking to Ann Wolfe again, who is curator currently at the San Jose Museum of Art, of an exhibit called Suburban Escape, The Art of California Sprawl, and she's curator of exhibitions and collections at the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno. Boy, talk about cars. You've got it covered in Reno, don't you? There are over 50 artists in the book here and over 20 artists in the exhibit devoted to significant parts of their career examining what we're calling suburban culture. We know a lot about suburban culture artistically. We don't know Robert Brugman points out in his book, perhaps as much about exurban culture, but what I'd like to do is find out what you think about this whole question of sprawl, again, talking about it from the political standpoint or from the standpoint of living and residing in it and aesthetically seeing it. And some of you who are certainly immersed in the art world or may have seen the exhibit at the San Jose Museum of Art may want to comment on what you see in the paintings and the sculpture, as well as the photography that ties in with what we're calling sprawl here. Your thoughts about sprawl as we kind of sprawl out here and take your phone calls. Let me give you a phone number to join us at. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. And again, that number for your phone calls now is 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you are enjoined and invited to join us. You can also join us by email. Our email address is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. Talking along with Ann Wolfe, with Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director of SPUR, and Robert Brugman, who is Professor of Art History and Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Illinois Chicago. His book is called Sprawl, A Compact History. Your thoughts on sprawl in politics, sprawl in living, sprawl in art. When we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The subject this hour is sprawl, and we've had a kind of, very, very civil, agreeable discussion of sprawl in terms of whether or not, what the pros and cons are, with Gabriel Metcalf of SPUR and Robert Brugman, who's the author of Sprawl, A Compact History. But still, Certainly it's clear that Gabriel Metcalf is a lot more negative about sprawl than Robert Brugman is, and Robert Brugman has some positive things to say about sprawl, which, as you can well imagine, has engendered already a lot of emails. Ann Wolfe is a curator of the San Jose Museum of Art's exhibit, Suburban Escape, The Art of California Sprawl, so we're kind of giving you a twofer this morning about the pros and cons of sprawl, as well as the world of art historically and aesthetically and its relationship to sprawl here in California. A few emails that we might want to get some response from before we go to your calls. Robert Brugman, just to give you a flavor of some of what we're reading from our listeners but via email, this is Gary who says, I'm listening to the conversation on sprawl, and I hope that you're going to discuss the more immediate devastating effects on wildlife and the local environment. House of Cards? Well, sprawl destroys habitat to a much greater degree than cities and is eating up farmland. There are other detrimental effects. Poor air quality from all these fireplaces and wood-burning stoves. And this comes from a listener named Mitko. Says, a lot of the sprawled areas look very nice, and of course it has advantages. My problem is you don't see any people, only cars, which makes it faceless. My view, the sprawl has a lot of heart but lacks soul. And John finally says, the author of the book Sprawl should, the book, by the way, is called Sprawl, A Compact History, should state what source he uses to prove that sprawl is not as environmentally damaging as condensed inner-city living. Every source I have ever read says just the opposite. His main argument is that we all should have the freedom to do anything we want to and have as much Bermuda grass around a tract mansion as you want. Spoiled, privileged, America is alive and well. Well, you want to respond to some of that, Robert Brugman?
Sure. Well, the social issues, the anonymity, the alienation, these are actually things that were said about the central city by sociologists just a generation ago. But let's go to the environmental one, because that's really, in many ways, the key one, and it trumps everything else these days. On wildlife habitat, this is an issue. Of course it's an issue. And I don't know what the answer to it is. But to say that somehow man is outside of nature and therefore has to be put out of bounds so that animals can have free rein and no men are there, that's not going to work. Every animal species has to share habitat. We haven't learned to do that very well. We're going to have to learn. But somehow just the idea that you bottle up all the human beings at high density and let the animals roam wild and all the rest, I don't think that's the answer. Even if it were, the urbanized area of the United States is very small. It's 5-7% at the largest figures that we can that we have, the largest estimates. So it's not very much. And as far as the environmental impact goes, I think you can readily understand that, let's say you put a house on 1 acre, a house on 2 acres, and everyone lived like that. At those kind of densities, you could get all of your energy on site, biomass, solar, wind, geothermal. So I don't think that there's necessarily any reason that we have to be at high densities anymore. In fact, there's some good research, and I'll just cite one example from a study that just came out of New South Wales. They show that per capita, the amount of energy used and the amount of greenhouse emissions is actually greater per capita in an apartment building, whether high-rise, mid-rise, or low-rise, than it is in a single-family house. Now, that's for Australia. It might not work here. But it just shows you that many of the things that we take for granted are just not the way they actually seem to be.
Gabriel Metcalf, let me bring you in here.
You know, I think the project of making low-density living more ecological is a great project, and I wish the professor a lot of luck on that. For now, energy consumed per capita across the world is vastly lower when people live at high densities. But at this point, I would agree that we can't force everybody to live in cities at high densities. What I would say our rallying cry should be is, let's allow people the chance to live in cities. In fact, because existing urban residents have the ability to prevent newcomers from moving in because of NIMBYism, because the federal government will match local funding for highways at greater rates than it will pay for public transit, because the federal government subsidizes sprawl by funding oil wars, a whole bunch of reasons like that. We are, in fact, forcing many people who would like to live in cities, we are forcing them to live in the suburbs. I think a good starting place would be to level the playing field and give everyone who wants to the chance to live in a city.
Just to dovetail on that, one of our listeners, Eamon, says urban sprawl is less of a problem than suburban sprawl. Single-use zoning, a.k.a. the banana rules, build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything, is what causes so many car journeys, leading to more road space, leading to more sprawl, leading to bigger distances between everyday needs, leading to more car journeys, and so on. High-density, pedestrian-friendly, mixed-use zoning is what could break this cycle of induced traffic and help us kick our oil addiction. And let me go to your phone calls. And first up, Bradley, good morning.
Hello. I'd like to bring to people's attention a wonderful book from 1976 called Public Places and Private Spaces by Albert Mehrabian, The Psychology of Workplace and Living Environments, where he discusses psychology and architecture and how they relate to each other, especially people's ability to screen or seek, ability to screen stimuluses and proclivity to seek them or shun them. And I'd just like to raise the question, how many people on the panel believe that we, especially in California, have the manners and character to live in higher density? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We thank you for the call. Manners to live in higher density? Gabriel Metcalf?
Sure we do. People who live in the city we're sitting in right now, San Francisco, have a great quality of life. Of course, there are troubled people everywhere, perhaps. But yes, we do have the manners, and it's a great thing walking down a city street.
Any thoughts from you, Robert Brugman, though you are situated in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, and I'm situated in my apartment in the central city, which I love. And if you notice, throughout history, some of the wealthiest people in the world have always lived at very high density. So I don't think it's a matter of one or the other being better or worse. I do think it's a good idea to try to give people as much choice as they can have, as long as you're not hurting anyone. And that, of course, that's the big issue, and that's where that subsidy comes in, and where I agree with Gabriel that we should level the playing field, although I think if we did, it probably would knock out a lot of the props for the central city rather than the suburbs.
And we now bring in a caller named Gabriel. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about what I've seen in the Bay Area growing up. I was born and raised here and still live here. I'm in my 30s, and a very dear childhood friend was in town last week, and we took one of our favorite drives up over Mount Tamalpais along Fairfax Bolinas Ridge and out in West Marin, and we cut over the hill heading back towards Fairfax, and the first thing that both of us noticed was the unbelievably disgusting brown air hovering over the bay from all the fires that have been burning. And we both got really sad because, you know, you saw that maybe one or two days a year when things were really cold or really hot, you know, in the summer or the winter months. As I've grown up, I've noticed it a lot and a lot more. The air quality in the Bay Area just kind of tanking, and I feel like it's a direct relation to the level of development that's been happening as the Bay Area has grown in size. I feel like it's just pushing closer and closer to the Sacramento Valley, and where there used to be space and farmland, it's just getting filled in, and I wonder what's being done for development these days to make it a little bit more smart and responsible than what it was in the 70s, 80s, 90s, obviously, when people were just building wherever. I'd like your thoughts, and I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, well, thank you for the call. Certainly, this is in your bailiwick, Gabriel Metcalf.
Yeah, well, that's a great comment, and you got a great name, too. I think there is a profound misunderstanding of what causes growth in our society. People think that if you simply oppose a new building on your block, that somehow that's stopping the growth. But in fact, all you are doing when you oppose a new apartment building on a city block is you are forcing the growth out to the suburban edge. The Central Valley is where the vast majority of California's growth is going because the existing urbanized areas are refusing to allow more people to move in. It is a very elitist attitude, and it's destroying the state.
Some more of your emails. This is from Jenna. Says, I work out in Antioch, an area which has a lot of sprawl and the types of big box malls where people tend to drive from one store to the next. The neighboring town, Brentwood, is also being taken over by development, but used to be orchards and farmland. Since eating locally grown food is an important way to counter fuel use, how can this happen when we are increasingly ripping out our local farmland for tract homes and Walmarts? And Rob says, you can't look at sprawl without looking at the negative social and health issues created by the non-dense suburban lifestyle. Epidemic obesity and diabetes, depression, detachment from social interaction, lack of exposure to traditional cultural activities that more dense environments offer. Looking at sprawl in Northern California in particular, any expansion nowadays takes place in either environmentally sensitive areas or dwindling agricultural land. Also, houses are equal to cars as far as contributors to global warming. Compact development creates much less warming per person. And Steve from Livermore says, I'm sympathetic to the arguments for compact development that are based on conserving open space and other environmental issues. However, I've lived in densely populated urban settings and always found the urban landscape depressing. Therefore, I resonate with your guest's comments about the improved standard of living afforded by sprawl. I live in Livermore, where recent development has been accompanied by preservation of open space in perpetuity. Ann Wolf, this whole debate as it's shaping up and everything really reflected in the exhibit and the artists. I mean, the range that we see.
It's actually quite interesting, the comments from many of those listeners. I was actually raised in the small town of Brentwood, the then small town of Brentwood in eastern Contra Costa County. I was raised on an apricot farm there. And in 1998, I watched as our neighbors bulldozed their orchard to make way for a gated golf course community. My family still continues to farm, surrounded by suburbia. And I realized the complexities and debates that continue to rage about growth in our area. It's interesting to look at the artists in this exhibition because I believe that none of them truly makes it a black and white issue. Suburbia is so many things and it has so many complicated facets to it that to be pro-growth or no growth or to take the side of simply a property rights advocate or a no-growth advocate or a developer is not the right answer. There needs to be more communication and look more broadly at issues related to sprawl in much the same way that many of the artists in the exhibition have done.
One of the more famous artists, of course, is Diebenkorn, and his Ingleside painting begins to look a lot like Cézanne. I mean, it's an interesting sense of bringing suburbia and, well, the countrysides that you associate maybe with Cézanne together.
Diebenkorn did something quite interesting. He was one of the earliest painters to...
And Robin's mentioning Wayne Thiebaud, too, in this context.
That's right. Yeah. Diebenkorn was one of the earliest painters to look at the suburb of Ingleside and to really kind of look at it with kind of an aesthetic interpretation. Interestingly, Diebenkorn kind of captured that spirit of suburbia in his Ingleside painting. He included those palm trees and those cul-de-sacs that were very much a part of California, the California suburban culture at the time. Thiebaud, most known for his pop art-inspired paintings of cakes and pies and still lives, he actually, like many artists, turned to suburban freeways in the 60s and looked at cars and traffic as kind of one of those popular subject matters at that time.
On we go to more callers. Tim, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Just a couple of comments. One, I work in suburban sprawl every day. I work down in the peninsula, and one of my huge objections to suburban sprawl is, one, plant life, the lawns that are planted, the amount of fertilizer that goes into lawns that are unused by people every day. And my other comment is I've lived in suburban sprawl almost my entire life, not my adult life, but my as a child, I was a military brat. So I went from military housing, year after year. And the one thing that I noticed about all the kids in military housing, because military bases are usually built away from most of the population, is we always escaped to the woods or to nature and never played on the playgrounds. Like, we were always given these huge playgrounds with swings and you name it. I mean, it was always supplied to us, and we almost never used them. An occasional kickball game, granted, but for the most part, most of our days, at least my friends and I, were spent in the woods playing, you know, war or whatever the games were that we were playing. So that's one thing that suburban sprawl has not offered is, you know, it might offer security, but it never really offers nature. And I mean nature in the way that people enjoy. It's, you know, it's fake nature. And I think, you know, down at a basic level, we all see that. It's fake nature. It's not real.
Well, you brought up a couple of points. I'd like to hear a response from Robert Brugman about all that fertilizer that's used or all the water. You could talk about resources with those sprawling lawns out in the suburbs, but also nature and children being able to play in nature.
Well, I don't disagree with any of those comments, and obviously these are issues. Water conservation is a major issue, and we may not need or want those lawns. We may not have them in 20 years. We may not be able to have them. But I find it hard to believe that you would say that there's a greater access to nature in the city. I think that's why many of the suburbanites moved out as they did. They wanted a connection with land. I think that's why there's such a strong reaction when you see an orchard or a grove chopped up for a new suburban subdivision. But let's take that issue of Brentwood or Antioch that several of the callers have asked about. You know, it's the anti-sprawl sentiment that led to the growth management and the growth boundaries in Contra Costa County. And it's typical that when you do something like that and you can't grow next to Antioch or Brentwood now, that growth is going to go to Stockton and Tracy. And in fact, that's what's happened. So that it's a very typical example of when you try to stop suburban sprawl by a kind of simple method like putting a growth boundary, that it causes problems that may arguably be worse than the sprawl itself.
Gee, for a Chicago guy, you're pretty familiar with this region.
Oh, I know the region pretty well. Because, you know, it's actually one of the great test cases. There's more controls, there's more environmental, there's more regulations of all kinds in California than there is anywhere else, particularly in the Bay Area. It's one of the reasons that you have ratios of house price to income that are now up at 11 and 12. These are historically the highest that the world has ever seen. They're probably very unsustainable.
Gabriel Metcalf.
Well, I really agree with the direction the professor's going with this. In fact, the Bay Area is filled with cities that tried to put in urban growth boundaries, but they did not do the other half of the equation. They did not upzone inside the urban growth boundaries. Thereby, all we did is push the sprawl a little farther out.
And we'll push for more of your calls. We go to Ken in Half Moon Bay. Morning, Ken.
Yes, good morning. One of the things I want to say that I have, or like to have Robert Brugman address is the fact that when you see a townless, you see lots of townless developments in sprawl, where people have to drive several miles to the nearest strip mall, which will have limited amenities. You know, you see so much of that in Santa Clara County. I grew up in the Bay Area and used to go down there and saw so much beautiful farmland just get paved over for people who have to now drive 3 or 4 miles or whatever just to get to the nearest strip mall. So I'd like to see hear what he has to say about that.
Professor Brugman.
He's made about sprawl today, you could hear in 19th century London or you could hear in any time in the past. And what happens is that after a period of time, any settlement, which could look kind of homogenous and raw and new when it's built, starts to develop more urban characteristics. So the Santa Clara Valley has been densifying very dramatically. If it hadn't been for a whole lot of activists trying to stop densification, as Gabriel has been talking about, if there's one thing that people hate more than sprawl at the edge, it's density near them. So what happens is over a time that things change, places become more urban, and we have this very interesting thing that the Santa Clara Valley, the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles and Orange County are starting to look much more like traditional cities as their densities are rising fairly dramatically.
Actually, you say in your book that we know little about exurban sprawl as opposed to suburban sprawl, and that's happening more and that's happening faster.
Yes, that's a really interesting thing. It's actually less of an issue out in California than it is in the East Coast, but if you think of the whole Napa and Sonoma valleys or the Gold Rush country, these are exurban. And by exurban, I mean what's beyond the regularly developed suburbia. And we really don't know much about it. Some of this exurbia looks like suburbs. A lot of it, though, like the Napa Valley, is very carefully tended so that it looks rural. And so most people don't think of it as sprawl, even though it's at much lower density than what they see at the edge of Gilroy or Marin County.
Ann Wolf, this word sprawl, it's something the linguists would say as a signifier that is that has bad associations in the minds of most people. And to put it with art, seems almost oxymoronic in some ways.
Well, you'll notice that the title of the exhibition is The Art of California Sprawl, and the main title is Suburban Escape. All of those components of the title do have double meanings. Suburban Escape actually comes from a well-known quote by Lewis Mumford. He wrote in 1961 in his book The City and History that the ultimate effect of suburban escape in our time is ironically a low-grade uniform environment from which escape is impossible. At the same time, escape from suburbia is considered a positive thing for many people, escaping the inner cities, the difficulties of the inner cities.
It's associated with white flight.
Absolutely. The Art of California Sprawl, I think that there are so many artists who have dealt with the art of this type of development over time. We have to put their voices together and introduce them into this discourse as well.
Well, we'll introduce another caller into our discourse, and all the way from Dallas, Texas, it's Marie. Good morning.
Good morning. Your comments and callers have hit it all on the nail. I am a nurse in Dallas. I serve the people of Dallas, and yet Dallas can't provide affordable housing in safe neighborhoods for me. And so I have to live in the suburbs, which means I have to commute. And so what I'm hoping for is that the hospitals will start coming my direction so my commute goes down. But with all of that comes the density, comes the people spreading out even further and further out. And all that I'm asking for are things simple, a reasonable place to live that doesn't cost me everything I've got and more that I'll never see the light of day. And then there's the added complications of things like good education. I don't know if Dallas is different than a lot of other cities, but I think the biggest problem is that we don't have the access in the city unless you're one of the wealthy people. For those of us who are smack in the middle class, solidly and productive and adding to the community, we just can't afford even the littlest basics in the city.
Well, you're talking about, you know, some profound questions in terms of affordable housing and what's called smart growth, all that, which brings me to you, Gabriel, and an emailer that kind of ties in nicely with the problems that Marie has outlined personally here. Alan, one of our listeners, says, what are Gabriel's solutions to sprawl? Higher densities in the cities, population control? It seems to me sprawl is absolutely necessary.
Okay, well, these are great questions. You know, the European model all through the post-war period was that wealthier people lived in the center, and the farther away you went, lower the income levels were. And in America, of course, it was exactly the reverse. We had this concept of the ghetto and the inner city as a zone of concentrated poverty. What we've seen since in the 1980s, starting in New York, and now certainly San Francisco, and I think city after city, is that historic American pattern is reversing, and we're now starting to look more like the European pattern, where the inner cities are places of wealth and privilege, and the phrase is, you drive till you qualify. And this is going to be a disaster for urbanism just as much as the ghetto and the concentrated poverty was a disaster for urbanism. You know, at Spur, we are certainly trying to promote infill development, compact development, and as the only way to end sprawl. But in order to make that actually work, what we really end up working on in a day-to-day way is making life in the city livable. So we're working on parks and schools and transit. And the caller from Dallas is absolutely right that you can't simply live at high densities and think you've solved the problem. That is only a start. From there, you have to make the quality of life really high, and you have to solve a whole bunch of problems. I think what we're talking about here is something that has not existed before, which is urbanism with social equality.
Let me thank Marie for her call, and I want to go to more of your calls here. Neil, good morning.
Hello. Yeah, you know, what it boils down to, what I'm hearing is about half the people hate sprawl, and the other half hate the inner city situation. And what it boils down to is that most people don't like other people very much. Maybe we ought to really go to the Chinese model, one person per family and or less, you know, to satisfy everybody. But here's a couple of other comments. First of all, somebody was complaining about air quality. Now, I remember the 40s and 50s, and at least as far as the inner city areas like San Francisco and Oakland, the visible smog was far worse in those days than it is now. And I realize that maybe the smog has spread out more to the outskirts, but the Central Valley was always bad too, visibly speaking. And L.A. is better now also. Another point, California is blessed with the fact that we are close, if a person has a car, to beautiful mountain and ocean and desert scenery and so on, and forest scenery, so everybody can get out of this very quickly. Even Los Angeles has spectacular mountain scenery within close reach of most people. A final point, would a possible good compromise be the row house type of thing, which is very popular in England, and which is typified by our Sunset District in Daly City, for example? Not that I really like that very much, but the fact is, those are fairly compact. They're not quite sprawl, but they're not quite urban. What do you think of that sort of a format?
What do you think, Robert Brugman?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the comments about air pollution are right on. In fact, all over America, all over the affluent West, air quality is much, much better than it was 50 years ago. Even with all the sprawl, air quality has gotten much better. So I think we need to look to technical fixes there rather than pushing the people around the landscape. But as far as the idea of row houses, that's already happening. The biggest American sprawl was between the 20s and 50s. In fact, the average size of lots has declined dramatically since the World War II, and we're seeing smaller and smaller lots in the 1990s, and we're seeing infinitely more row houses than we've ever seen before. In fact, what's happening on the fringe of almost every American city is that it's become lower middle class people that are living there and middle class, not the affluent, and they're typically living in bigger houses but on much smaller pieces of land than even 20 years ago.
That's the note we're going to have to end on. I want to extend thanks to all our callers and our listeners, also to our guests, Robert Brugman.
Thank you.
Professor of Art History and Architecture, Urban Planning, University of Illinois. Again, his book is Sprawl, A Compact History. Thanks to Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director of SPUR, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, and to Ann Wolf, Curator of the San Jose Museum of Art's exhibit, Suburban Escape, The Art of California Sprawl. It'll be there until March 4th. We'll be back with you tomorrow if all goes according to plan. And we thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, with production assistance from Elsa Chang. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.